I wanted to write some content that was very easy to read. It was stick to the basics of the foundation of mental health response. We incorporated the training in San Antonio very early on to invite the firefighters and paramedics to the training as well. It was almost like you had to cross train because you were responding to the same calls anyway. If you're in law enforcement and you are about to build these types of co-response teams, please humble yourself. Know your lane, keep the scene safe, but be willing to have an open mindset and learn. Of all the training I think I've ever received in law enforcement, nothing can compare to real-time crisis intervention with a clinician.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Rumley, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Ernie Stevens. He's the author of the number one best-selling book, Mental Health and De-escalation, A Guide for Law Enforcement Professionals. We'll be talking about crisis intervention, mental health, and de-escalation. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms. Check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Ernie after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis.
While responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress.
Burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers.
With vital information and resources,
resilience strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts, retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rimley, LCSW, EMTB.
This episode is made possible by Rebound by Restore Ear, revolutionary cold therapy for hearing loss prevention. To learn more, visit RestoreEar.com. That's RestoreEar.com.
We'd like to welcome back Ernie Stevens to the show here. He is a number one best-selling author on Amazon with the book titled Mental Health and De-escalation, A Guide for Law Enforcement Professionals. Ernie was also contributing author for Police Mental Barricade. And as far as work, he was a police officer for 28 years, serving 26 of those on the San Antonio Police Department, where he was a founding member of the Mental Health Unit. Ernie's been featured on the Emmy Award HBO documentary, Ernie and Joe, Crisis Cops, and has been featured in over 27 publications and deemed an expert in crisis intervention training. Ernie continues to support law enforcement agencies around the nation by providing technical assistance and best practice approaches to mental health crisis calls. Ernie, welcome back to Respond to Resilience.
It's fantastic to be back. I must have done something right last time to get an invite, so I appreciate it.
It's great to see you again.
Likewise, my friends. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Ernie, I'd like to start by asking you, what sprung the idea of writing a book?
It wasn't my idea, I can tell you that. I got a phone call from Nick Ruggiero, who's written several books. I wrote the foreword to Police Mental Health Barricade, which was a book about police leadership and the high rate of suicide and stress within law enforcement. So I had a good relationship in working with him and having these types of discussions. And then he reached out to me in 2021 and said, hey, do you want to co-author a book together? I've never written a book in my life. I'm like, well, what do you want to do it on? And he's like, I don't know. How about homicide? I'm like, homicide? Well, I've worked some homicides. I was never assigned to homicide, but what about mental health? He's like, I'm an idiot, man. Sorry, I forgot who I was talking to. Yeah, let's do mental health. So it just so happened that we both had COVID at the same time, didn't know it. And he's like, hey, you know, you write 50 pages, I'll write 50 pages, and then we'll come together and see where we landed on it. So I didn't know what he was writing. He didn't know what I was writing. My portion ended up being almost 70 pages because I had a lot to say. And even that is condensed. And when we got back together and I read his portion, it was more from the perspective of a supervisor. He's a sergeant in Alexandria and a supervisor in the importance of the training, where mine was more boots on the ground and the training. And it was a really good mix. And he really did me a solid because he cut a lot of his material because he liked what I was offering as far as the instructional part of the content of the book. So he gave me, you know, over half the book easily.
So what is it that you really wanted your readers to understand about the topic and the content of the book?
You know, it's so important, the topic of crisis intervention training. And there's so many smaller agencies that just don't get the quality of the training that a good 40-hour, quote-unquote, Memphis model provides. So I wanted to write some content for those officers that was very easy to read. It was stick to the basics of the foundation of mental health response in the intersections of law enforcement, the criminal justice system, and behavioral health. Because I think it's important to understand that, you know, law enforcement's been asked to do everything and anything, right, when the call comes in. But we were not properly equipped to respond to these mental health calls. And still, I'll argue today, even with CIT training, we're still not equipped. I mean, we're just scratching the surface, right? So I really wanted the reader to get a sense of the basics of crisis intervention and focus on the person and not the problem when they were interacting with that individual in crisis.
So Ernie, I know you're out there quite a bit speaking, training, going to conferences, and I would assume you're also presenting this material perhaps in the classroom for police officers, maybe even at the academy level. Can you speak a little bit about how you're delivering it or how it's being used in those contexts?
Well, thank goodness that there was actually a good response when the book was released, because as much as I travel, I can't be everywhere, right? So it's so much better for agencies, police organizations, amongst other agencies, to see the value in the book and then incorporate this into their libraries or their training. And that's exactly what happened. I've kept a list of agencies that have ordered this book. We're up to over 173 agencies now, police agencies, law enforcement, that have either supplied this book to their officers, made it part of their library, or actually incorporated it into their police academy as part of their training when they do get to that portion for mental health. So, you know, it truly was a blessing that this book really did the talking on its own. I didn't have to go out and really push it and market it and say, hey, this is a great book. Because those who have ever written a book know these are not money-making opportunities. They truly aren't. They take a lot of effort and energy. And really all you're trying to do is get some really good quality content out to the reader and hope that they can find value and then add benefit to their organization or their community. The interesting thing about the book was right away I was getting messages on LinkedIn saying, hey, I picked up your book. I'm a single mom, and now I better understand, you know, what my daughter's dealing with when it comes to bipolar disorder. Or we are actually a hospital, and we purchased this book for our behavioral health unit for them to read because it's important that they understand the effectiveness of active listening and de-escalation, because they really don't get that kind of training in the hospital environment. So it was really a truly an eye-opening experience to see who was ordering the book and then what their feedback was, you know, once we finally received some feedback.
It's so cool that it's being used in that hospital context because, you know, you as a police officer, us as a fire EMS unit, often will take a patient to the hospital for behavioral health and hand them off. And we often see, you know, the way they're handled at that point is really from lack of maybe experience and awareness. And so cool that your book is being used in that context to kind of fill in that gap.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. And this is not to bash medical staff, because God bless their heart. They are overworked, stressed. But you're right. What they don't see is the officer, the medic, spending an hour, 2 hours de-escalating this individual. So there's not a use of force incident, only to get them to a receiving facility and then be brushed off like, hey, have a seat. There's 25 people in front of you. We'll get to you when we get to you. And now you're no longer a priority. You're no longer the focus of the crisis, and that can have adverse effects. So you make a valid point, and I think that's the importance of treatment facilities, receiving facilities, understanding the importance and know what officers are doing out in the field prior to them bringing a patient to their facility.
According to recent studies, over half of firefighters report changes to their hearing since entering the fire service. This can be attributed to exposure to loud noise. Over time, special cells in our ears, which transmit auditory information to our brain, become damaged or die due to an inflammatory response, resulting in noise-induced hearing loss. However, there is a solution. Therapeutic hypothermia, commonly known as cooling, can reduce inflammation and injury. Take control of your hearing health with research-backed Rebound, an effective way to reduce inner ear damage associated with hearing loss after loud noise exposure. Early studies show that wearing Rebound after a fire shift results in better hearing function. Rebound can help protect firefighters' hearing and reduce the risk of long-term damage. Don't wait to protect your hearing. It's time to Rebound. Visit RestoreEar.com to get your Rebound today.
So I have a question about the, how does your book differ from the materials that came before you? Like, what did you really want to hit home, you know, and make a difference by saying?
Yeah, you know, some of the material you'll find in probably 99% of other CIT classes, right? Active listening. Okay. I modeled that training after the FBI's MORPI acronym on how they teach active listening. A lot of agencies have adapted that. But what I also added in the book that I've never seen really in any other book is there's a chapter on EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment Active Labor Act. And it's a medical term really that talks about the rights of the patient and their ability to receive treatment. What police departments did not know was how truly that was affecting their transportation and drop off at a facility with a patient. And this is what I mean. So many times before the training, I would take a patient to a treatment facility and then be asked, what kind of insurance do they have? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't ask that. Let me find out. And then, okay, hey, they're unfunded. Oh, you can't come here. You need to go to your county hospital. We can't take them. And I'm like, okay, I didn't know. I'd put them back in the car and drive them across town. It wasn't until I went to a EMTALA class that was being taught by Medicaid Office of Health and Human Services through the Inspector General's office, where I learned that it doesn't matter about a patient's ability to pay. This is an emergency status. It covers all patients, whether you have an emergency room red sign or not. If that facility and one-third of the patients are unscheduled walk-in patients and they accept Medicare, Medicaid, then that patient has a right to be assessed and triaged. And at that point, once we do transfer them to a higher level of care, we are not required to stay with that patient. Police departments have been doing that out of archaic policies that have been put in place. And the number one complaint you hear is, I don't like doing mental health calls because I got to sit at the hospital all night long. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, according to EMTALA, that's your choice, because we've even had a ruling from a judge saying that once you've transported that patient to a higher level of care, it now becomes the care of that facility. And there's so much more that goes into that chapter about EMTALA that the idea was I wanted to educate the officers on what their rights were, the rights of the patient, how that could possibly affect them in their own personal lives, like it did me when I took my dad to the hospital, and then give them just it. Knowledge is power, I guess, but to also give them an appreciation of what the receiving facilities are up against when it comes to capacity and ability to care for a patient.
So outside of the hospital setting, talk about some pointers you have for departments on how to collaborate with mental health agencies in the community. How can people really build those relationships, and can it be from the ground up or should it be leadership down?
I think it does have to start with leadership, and I'll give you an example of what happened in San Antonio. It was early 2000. We did not have a good relationship with our local mental health authority. In fact, we avoided them at all cost if we had a patient, because the routine was you came across a patient in the field in crisis, You took your time to de-escalate. You transported him to the local mental health authority to be assessed. Before they can be assessed, then they're telling you, you have to go get medical clearance. Although the patient seems fine, maybe they were mildly depressed and having suicidal thoughts. Now I have to put the patient back in my vehicle, go to a hospital, sit there for who knows how long, just to come back to say, okay, they're medically cleared, for a clinician to say, yes, they meet the criteria for inpatient care. So now you need to transport them to this facility over here who can accept them. And that's your entire shift. So law enforcement was like, I'm not messing. Like, really? What? There has to be an easier way. So we are not going to use them. We'll find another way. Unfortunately, a lot of the times, individuals in a mental health crisis were improperly incarcerated because of their mental illness, or they were taken to another jurisdiction and left, or whatever the outcome was. Very rarely, and I say that cautiously, was law enforcement truly collaborating with their mental health facilities to get the patient the type of care they needed. So what happened in San Antonio, leadership came together, new leadership from the Behavioral Health Authority, said, hey, we want to make law enforcement our priority, our number one customer, and we're going to build a new diversion center. So we want you at the table as we build and construct this building to tell us what works best for law enforcement the moment you arrive. Now, that was huge. I got to be on the planning committee on how the building was set up, the policies and procedures that were being written for the police department on how to access this facility, how long the facility said it was going to take to assess a patient for mental health. And they also put on a medical unit here where we could do a minor medical clearance as well, which a lot of times, again, you got to go get medical clearance before you bring a patient somewhere, and they can do that there. So the idea, the promise we got from them was 15 minutes or less for a mental health assessment and you're out the door, 30 minutes or less for a medical triage, and then you're out the door. And to this day, they've kept their promise, and that's what's made this so successful in San Antonio. Leadership came together. There was a plan. It was sold to the patrol division, who reluctantly didn't have a choice but to do it because of policy, only to find out that this was a better way of doing things.
That's great. And talk about a turnaround. And it's
better
for the patient. It's not just better for you. It's better for the patients. And
but yeah, and that's just it, Bonnie. It can never be about me. That call can never be about me. It has to, the focus has to be on the patient. I'm not the one in crisis. I've got to finish my shift till 6 a.m. or whatever, no matter what. It's just I would like to be able to give an appropriate response to a patient as efficiently as I can, and then continue to help my community when the calls continue to come in. And I think the reason law enforcement was so frustrated was they're with this patient listening to their radio call after call coming out in their area, and they're feeling useless. You know, another officer is like, ah, wow, what's taking so long for this officer to check back in service? It's like, you know what's taking so long. So it was a win-win situation. Truly was.
Yeah. Your point is so true that on those crisis intervention calls, you're really involving not only law enforcement, but EMS and possibly fire and other agencies that are all on scene for prolonged periods of time until the scene is de-escalated and made safe and able to get to the point where you can transport the patient. So an amazing way to free up those resources and make it a win for not only the patient, but also the agencies.
And David, you hit on something important, right? That EMS a lot of times is on the scene, fire is on the scene. We incorporated the training in San Antonio very early on to invite the firefighters and paramedics to the training as well. Mm-hmm. It was almost like you had to cross train because you were responding to the same calls anyway. Mm-hmm. And we learned something very important during the training, that the medics were extremely good communicators because they didn't rely on anything on their utility belt, right? They didn't have a taser, pepper spray, gun, handcuffs. All they had was their ability really to communicate, but they were experts at it because they knew how to avoid conflict. Where in law enforcement, it's like, hey, if conflict comes, I got something for that. Okay, relax, calm down. So we would pair an officer with a medic and send them into a role play. Now, what we saw from the medics were, hey, y'all walked right by this knife, that bag of cocaine, and everything else just so you can get down, touch the patient on the knee and tell them everything's going to be okay. So back up. Let's talk about scene safety. We had to teach that. And then we had to learn how to communicate with each other using a common language. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the medics were saying, hey, this is actually a medical issue, but police were putting them in our EMS unit without, we didn't know, they weren't like checking them for weapons. And then a lot of times on the way to the hospital, we would find a knife. We could possibly find a gun. We would find other weapons or contraband or drugs. And it would help if we were all communicating at the scene to transport the patient in a manner that's safe for everybody.
Yes, those are great points. And I've lived exactly what you're talking about and made sure to advocate as a fire officer to advocate for the EMS personnel that the patient is checked for weapons or any contraband before we get them in the ambulance and they're back there with a solitary provider. So working as a team, that's huge, Ernie. I'm so glad that you were able to accomplish that.
Responder Resilience is your place for insightful discussions for emergency services professionals, including law enforcement, EMS, fire service, 911 telecommunicators, animal control, rescue squads, K-9 officers, corrections, trauma-informed therapists, and agency leaders. We bring you leading experts and influencers in emergency services, sharing knowledge and tools to improve the culture of wellness and to inspire excellence in leadership. Tune in live every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time for the weekly premiere on YouTube and Facebook. Or stream episodes anytime on ResponderTV.com or on your favorite podcast platform. Stay current with hot topics, informative content, and get valuable insights on how to lead a healthier life both on and off the job by subscribing to us on YouTube and Facebook. Responder Resilience is committed to our family of public safety professionals. Remember to like and subscribe today.
This episode is made possible by Rebound by Restore Ear, revolutionary cold therapy for hearing loss prevention. To learn more, visit RestoreEar.com. That's RestoreEar.com.
I wanted to ask you, too, about clinicians, because you mentioned that. What did you learn in the field working with clinicians? How was that experience?
That was phenomenal. Of all the training I think I've ever received in law enforcement, all the courses I've ever been to, nothing can compare to real-time crisis intervention with a clinician. Because I got to sit back. Well, number one, law enforcement has to know their lane, right? Scene safety. Once that is secure, please be quiet and get out of the way and become an expert observer, because what you're about to see is liquid gold. You get to watch a 6-year master's level clinician do their thing. And I was learning so much, like, why? And it was great, because after the call was finished, we would go and debrief. I'm like, hey, I got to ask, why were you asking about shadows? Why did you ask who the president was? Like, none of that. I would never ask. Why? And I had to learn, like, oh, okay. So we're trying to look at cognition. We're trying to see, is a person oriented? All this made sense because I had the authority to do the involuntary commitment. Mm-hmm. The social worker in Texas, a medic in Texas, a doctor in Texas cannot involuntarily commit somebody. Mm-hmm. A law enforcement, a judge, or a parent and legal guardian. And I, even though I had that authority, I was very undereducated on how to use that authority in a proper way to help a patient. So by riding with a clinician and listening to how they were talking to a patient, and then better yet, as soon as that interaction was done, I got to listen to the clinician call the provider and staff that case with a provider and get the provider's feedback. So not only am I watching the clinician do their magic, then I get to hear a doctor come in and give their perspective. And it was amazing. And I think if you're in law enforcement and you are about to collaborate and build these types of co-response teams, please humble yourself, know your lane, keep the scene safe, but be willing to have an open mindset and learn.
So Ernie, what are some of the biggest challenges with de-escalation, like specifically for police?
I think it's patience and empathy. It's very difficult to teach empathy, but without it, you're not going to make a connection. Earlier, I said you got to focus on the person and not the problem, right? Because the problem is usually emotionally charged. But once you can get past that and focus on the person, you can make a connection over correction, right? The problem will correct itself if you de-escalate properly. I think it takes time for officers to truly understand what empathy is. And to truly understand what empathy is, they have so much more learning to do, right? You need to understand what trauma is, right? If you don't know what trauma isn't what happened to you. Trauma is what happens inside of you as a result of what happens to you. So it's like we have to train up the officers to truly understand trauma-informed care, empathy, connection, and that takes time. And I was fortunate enough to be in a unit where I had the opportunity to get that kind of training. We're in a CIT course, a 40-hour course, although it's a good amount of training. I don't know if you're truly going to get all that value in adverse childhood experiences, really digging in on implicit bias training to understand how that translates to a person in crisis. Mm-hmm. So I think the difficult part is officers investing on their own time to learn about mental health and crises mm-hmm. calls. And it's just something I fell in love with. So it was very simple for me to take time and learn about it and read and watch documentaries and ask a lot of questions for people a lot smarter than me. And I just think in today's law enforcement, where they're understaffed, they're having difficulty recruiting and retaining officers, every call is a Band-Aid and on the way to the next call. And that's mm-hmm. difficult when it comes to crisis response.
I think that a lot of civilians would view police work as so black and white, but you're speaking to the gray area and really understanding that police don't just see a crime. They can look behind the crime and understand what has led this person to this behavior, right? So I would imagine, and I haven't been in your shoes, but I'm imagining some of the calls, you know, for shoplifting, and you get there and it's a mother trying to feed her child, or some of these situations that I think people don't think of. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, well, you already just talked about it. You have to look at what is the root of the problem, right? If you've got a palm tree in your backyard and a leaf dies and you call an arborist to come out, they're not going to touch the leaf. They're not going to touch the tree itself. They're going to take a soil sample to say, hey, what's wrong with the soil? Is it low on nitrogen, phosphorus? And the minute they determine that, they put that amount of fertilizer in, and then leaf comes back, right? Same thing with people. What is the root of the problem that escalated to a crime today or a disturbance that allowed the police to come out? A lot of times it could be, and we just talked about it, a person did not properly take into consideration the trauma that they experienced at a younger age and that they've never processed it. So this trauma has now compounded and it gets triggered when there's an event. And then that event leads to shoplifting, trespassing, these minor offenses that take up over 50% of the population in the jails, right? Which that's a whole nother discussion that we get into. Hopefully bring me back. Like, let's just keep this going. But you have to get, like, what is the root of the problem? So I always try to, like, ask, in the last 72 hours, tell me, like, what has transpired? Because over 72 hours, I can get a little bit of a better picture of what's been going on with this person, especially if I've got a family member or friend to say, hey, we noticed the behavior started to decline couple of days ago. Okay, tell me about that. What changed? What was the event? Was there a change in medication? Like, if you have to get to the root of it, Bonnie, and you nailed it. You can't start with just, hey, this is the problem. Let's deal with this. You can't. Let's focus on the person, like I said, and get back to the root cause of what happened, and then we can find out a good treatment plan for this patient.
I wanted to just jump into a topic that, you know, we've heard from other crisis intervention police officers who were on scene for a very highly charged, dramatic, possibly dangerous call, that afterwards they have the adrenaline dump. And in one case, you know, the officer was savvy enough to call for like a defusing debriefing right there on scene and ask for help. In your experience, how did you cope with those kind of calls? And what was your go-to in terms of, you know, coping mechanisms?
Wow. On the police side, we don't really have time to process, right? Mm-hmm. I went to a critical incident stress management class that was put on by the fire department. And what I learned was after a critical incident, they were able to go back to their station, shut down. Other fire stations would pick up those calls for X amount of time. and let that company decompress and do a critical incident stress. I'm like, hold on, y'all get to do what?
Yeah.
Like, no, right. Like, this, I just watched this person jump off a bridge and like, okay, call's over. We're going to have EMS pick up, transport, or have night CID come out, take pictures, whatever. But y'all hit your 10-8 button and get back and go to the next call. Mm-hmm. That's the reality of what it's like. And it's like, well, hold on. Like, I just spent 2 hours talking to this person and this just happened. I don't even know if I can finish my shift. Well, hit your 10-8 button and keep going because the calls are stacking up. So what helped me, one, I did not cope very well. I'm just going to be completely honest. I didn't cope until I retired. Then I said, oh, I have time to deal with this now. And then it was a flood of emotions, flood of emotions. And my body just felt exhausted because I finally had time to start processing some of the trauma that I had experienced. But it all came at once. I was like, damn, like, can I just focus on this one event, kind of deal with this? But it all came at once. Mm-hmm. What helped me get through the shift, and if your viewers, your listeners have seen Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops on HBO, it's still streaming. You know, I was partnered up with Joe at the time. So we were kind of our coping mechanisms to decompress because we rode to work together. So we were able to ride home together. And we used that time either just to be quiet, to listen to music, to talk about the call, to talk about plans for this coming weekend, to kind of get our minds somewhere else. Because the last thing you want to do, and so many officers do it, and I was guilty as can be, guilty as charged, is go home. And now, hey, family, guess what I dealt with? Or I completely shut off and don't want to talk about it at all. Right. I become irritable, which is a dangerous place to be. So to find that coping mechanism within law enforcement, I think that search is still happening, David. I think it depends on what type of culture of wellness has your organization put in place to support you. Not just check the box, culture of wellness, a true, robust program saying it's okay not to be okay. It's just not okay to stay that way. And we have all these different resources to help you cope. And we're going to be with you, right? I think that's just so important. And they just don't sell that picture when they're recruiting, right? Look at the recruiting pamphlets, SWAT, canine, helicopters. You know, where's the officer with their arm around another officer saying, hey, we're going to get through this together? I think we do a poor job of that.
Come on.
Check it.
I do think isolation is really a big problem for police, right? I mean, you had Joe, and like you said, you talked to him. I don't think that happens, you know, in all departments where there's two cops riding together. You know, you've got an ambulance. There's always a paramedic and an EMT or maybe another paramedic. Fire, you described how they handle things. They sit around. They also sit around and have a meal together, right? And even if they're not talking about the call, they're cracking jokes. They're changing that channel in their head. And I think that's one way that police differ is the solitude that they suffer with. And the skill of compartmentalization, which is necessary for all first responders. I think police have it in spades. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? They tuck it in there. And then they move on, as you said, you know, get back out there. You have another call to answer. And then that just percolates in their, you know, wherever they put it, in the closet in their head, the bucket in their head, whatever you want to call it. It just percolates.
It does. And, you know, what excites me is where I work now, the Council of State Governments Justice Center. We are the technical assistance advisor for over 93 grantees for a Connect and Protect grant. So these are agencies that have partnered with their behavioral health partner to build out a co-response. And a lot of times, Stacey, that co-response looks like a clinician in a vehicle with an officer. Mm-hmm. So on the surface, it's a great alternative response to the community. Mm-hmm. But what that means on the inside of the organization is an officer has direct access to a clinician. And I love what they did in Denver. The BJA just put out a podcast yesterday with Carly Salon, who's a licensed clinical social worker that works also at the Justice Center. And she talked about this specifically about officers would rotate through this detail to sign up to ride with a clinician to do co-response. And it was amazing how many times an officer signed up to ride with a clinician based on what was going on at home, right? It was like, hey, I haven't seen you ride with me before. Can I talk to you about something? My 16-year-old's about to, you know, give me a heart attack. She's doing this or he's doing that. And it really became very therapeutic within the walls and the confines of law enforcement. So even though we are really bad about isolation, there is hope. And as we progress and change how we redefine what safety is, right? It can't be the absence of crime. It has to be the presence of well-being. And if we can understand that, recognize it, we can build out these robust programs and work wellness from within and let that spill over to the community.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm hoping to see much more of that in the future. We have some of it locally here where there are embedded clinicians with the department. And it's such a smart dual purpose. You know, how you described it, they have a dual purpose. They're in the building. They're there for all of the mental health calls, but they're really there for the officers, too. And I think if that embedded clinician has the personality and is the right fit for that department, it could save so many lives. And that part you can't measure, but we measure it all the time when we look at the stats, when we look at the suicide rates and what are the things that are really happening to police. I would love to see more of this in the future because I think it's a win. The right person, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, you bring them in for your in-service training. You let them be a part of it. You let every single officer that rotates through in-service training see who they are, listen to their story. And, you know, Joe and I had an opportunity one year that they gave us an update. Hey, you have to teach an 8-hour update at in-service this year on mental health. And by the way, the state didn't change any of the material that y'all taught 4 years ago. And I'm like, oh, can we then just highlight like the things they really wanted us to touch on and free up some space on things that are really important as well. And the Academy commander's like, yes, as long as you meet the training objectives. I'm like, of course, sir. Like, yeah, no problem. But then we talked about officer wellness, and Joe talked about, he got very like vulnerable and authentic and started talking about his addiction to porn. And I'm not telling you anything he wouldn't tell you, but about his addiction to porn and how he's had 3 divorces and 5 kids and all this child support and how he's felt suicidal. Mm-hmm. And he would tell the story and the clinicians would talk about coping skills and resources. And for the first time for that year, we had 30 officers approach us and get into treatment that had never been into treatment before.
Awesome.
And all it took, now, granted, I did get called in, hey, by leadership, hey, we understand Joe was saying he was suicidal. Like, is he okay? And I'm like, you're just not asking these questions. Like, he's talking about 7 years ago, you know, getting out of the military as a Marine and the things he struggled with. Yeah. Like, if you knew this, if you knew your rank and file better and who we are and what we do, you wouldn't be asking me this. You would be asking, how can we be a part of this? If you got 30, how can we get 60 next year?
Right.
So as frustrating as it is to try to get the message out, it is truly rewarding when you see these kind of numbers for the first time.
Right. And I think it had a lot to do with Joe's vulnerability. Right. He you know, I'm sure he's well respected in the department. Right. And there, people are thinking, wow, this guy is struggling with these things, but he's still a strong person. He's still a functioning cop. And he went and got help. And look at him now. Right. And so he actually ends up giving permission to other officers. And then I think you had that influx of people like seeking treatment. Right. So he modeled that and he prompted them to get over their resistance and be the, you know, go on to get help so they can be the best person that they can be.
Right. I mean, it's a no-brainer, right? If your officers are healthy and they're well and they're in a good place, they're going to come to work and do a good job, be excited about coming to work and help the community to the best of their ability.
Mm-hmm.
But if they are drained and exhausted and there's just cynicism, which I've seen, mm-hmm. How do you think that translates to the community that calls for help and they show up with that kind of attitude? It's like, mm-hmm. Lord, like you're making me feel worse than when I called in I was expecting to get some hope. Some help, and man, I feel worse. Like, leave, mm-hmm. don't mm-hmm. come back. It took the ability to be vulnerable, to open yourself up and say, hey, for so long, I wore this mask of my representative self, but it truly wasn't who I was behind the mask. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to take it off, and it's okay to ask for help. And, you know, just there's power when other officers can see that in
yes.
peers,
right?
Right, I think it. And then if you can see it in a peer in leadership position, it does even so much more. Mm-hmm. But that's the hardest nut to crack, is to get a leader, a wow. chief, an assistant chief, a deputy chief, to say, oh, I've struggled too, and I didn't know what to do, and I was suicidal. But this is – they won't – they're fine. They're perfect. Their gold stuff doesn't ever tarnish. And it's like, that's not fair. You're sending the wrong message. Like, your rank and file needs to know that it's okay to need some resources and help at times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This episode is made possible by Rebound by Restore Ear, revolutionary cold therapy for hearing loss prevention. To learn more, visit RestoreEar.com. That's RestoreEar.com.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stanford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. Visit our website at fctrt.org or find us on Instagram at FairfieldCountyTRT.
Well, Ernie, you're so inspiring because you're always working on the next thing. You know, if we know something about you, you're very hardworking and you have goals. So can you talk to us? What are you working on now? What's next for Ernie?
Wow. So a lot of things. So at work, because I actually have a job, like we talked about earlier, we are helping over 93 different grantees set up co-responder teams. In addition to that, a lot of them are expanding a community responder program as well. So a community responder program is like a medic or medical professional working with a clinician, where now you've actually removed law enforcement from this type of response at all. And we've seen some of these in the past. The Denver STAR program has been extremely successful. I'm very excited to be working on a lot of 988 work at the national level, and how we need to build out a good framework to get law enforcement truly to understand how 988 works, when and how to triage these calls and do a proper transfer, because some guidance has come out. The Department of Justice put out guidance last year saying that a mental health call should warrant a mental health or behavioral health response. If that's available, and you're sending law enforcement only, that could be viewed as a civil rights violation. Right. And this is new guidance that just came out, that law enforcement is going to be scratching their head going, what is this? Because it just has not made its rounds. I'm working on putting that information out to agencies saying, look, we really need to look at and evaluate other alternative type responses. And really by incorporating 988, mobile crisis, and trying to limit as much as we can law enforcement responding to behavioral health calls if possible. So mm-hmm. that's one thing. I've got some other things working personally. I'm very excited that Ernie and Joe is still streaming on HBO, but I may have some big news coming in the future that I can't release yet, but just follow and like that film. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised what's going to happen here pretty soon.
Fantastic. We've covered a lot of amazing ground here today. And just please share with us where people can find you out there in social media, website, things like that.
Yeah, I wish I was more present. I just don't have as much time as I'd like. But I'm on LinkedIn, Ernest Stevens, LinkedIn. I'm out there. And then at Twitter, eStevens0845. You'll never guess what my badge number was. everybody's PIN number, phone security code. Sorry, officers, I just gave away your biggest secret. But yeah, Twitter, LinkedIn is probably the easiest way. And then ErnestStevens.com is a link to where you can find the book, but you can also just send me a message. I had a message come in this morning about a resource question. So it doesn't just have to be, I went on that site to order your book. Feel free to reach out to me, send me a question. I'm very responsive to all interactions that I get. I'm very happy to be able to converse with anybody that wants to have a conversation on this.
Fantastic. And the book is called Mental Health and De-escalation, a Guide for Law Enforcement Professionals. And that's available on your website and Amazon.
Correct. Yeah. You can get a signed copy on my website. It's available on Amazon with ebook, Audible, and paper and hardback copy. So yeah, it's available. Thank you so much for plugging that. You didn't have to do that. I appreciate it.
It's important stuff. And we want to thank you, Ernie, for joining us again and sharing this wealth of information that I think is game changing in the profession. So we appreciate you very much.
Well, I appreciate it. Y'all are a group of wonderful people doing wonderful work. I've said it before, David, your podcast saves lives because the guests that you bring on and the information and the content that they put out, I know for a fact has helped people. I've received messages saying, hey, I heard this message on your podcast and I'm reaching out for help. And I think we've emailed back and forth and I've shared that with you. So again, thank you for what you're doing. I know this takes your time, your energy, but your passion for what you do truly is making a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ernie.
Thank you.
Thanks for everything that you do. No, we really appreciate you and you're helping our clients as well. Just so you know, when we tell them about your book and they go and buy it, you know, or they sit in our waiting room and read it. So thank you for that, too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Please remember to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.